This is TWiT.
This is what's interesting. As on Friday of last week, Google's security blog post was titled "A Spectre Proof of Concept for a Spectre Proof Web." Google's created and is sharing a working Spectre exploit written in JavaScript that's able to obtain data from the browser's internal memory. So the way we sort of left Spectre was Intel, as we know, said, oh, crap, let's make this better. And so they updated a bunch of microcode to perform mitigations. But then there was some pushback by the researchers who were able to demonstrate that, you know, you were still having speculative execution problems. And remember also that this enabling these features noticeably reduced processor performance, because the reason they were put in the first place was to gain significant enough processor performance that it was worth dramatically increasing the processor complexity in order to provide all this crazy branch prediction logic, down at the silicon level. But the way things kind of got left was that there would still be some obligation on the part of the application, at the application layer, to take a little bit of responsibility for this. Not everything could be done down in the silicon. So in Google's introduction, in their security blog posting of this, they wrote, three years ago, Spectre changed the way we think about security boundaries on the web. It quickly became clear that flaws in modern processors undermined the guarantees that web browsers could make about preventing data leaks between applications. As a result, web browser vendors have been continuously collaborating on approaches intended to harden the platform at scale. Nevertheless, this class of attacks still remains a concern and requires web developers to deploy application-level mitigations. And we're going to come back to this, because this is the good news is that there's something that can be done. The bad news is that this needs to be done, and it's entirely optional, which makes me think, you can hope, but we'll see. So they said, in this post, we will share the results of Google security team's research on the exploitability of Spectre against web users and present a fast, versatile proof of concept written in JavaScript which can leak information from the browser's memory. That's not good. They said, we've confirmed that this proof of concept or its variants function across a variety of operating systems, processor architectures, and hardware generations. By sharing our findings with the security community, we aim to give web application owners a better understanding. Okay, web application owners, right? The guys who, as I mentioned, will need to add some headers to their servers, to the headers to the queries and responses that their web application servers generate, if they are going to be proactive in taking responsibility for mitigating these problems. So what's cool about this is that Google is saying, look, here it is. If you don't fix this, this is what can happen to your application, folks. So they said, finally, this post describes the protections available to web authors and best practices for enabling them in web applications, which is where we're going to spend a little bit of time. So the link to their posting is in the show notes for anyone who's curious. So I'm going to only share the important bits from what is a lengthy post. And everybody knows what Spectre is, so I'm going to skip that. So here's some interesting and underappreciated facts affecting browsers. They wrote, in 2019, the team responsible for V8, Chrome's JavaScript engine, published a blog post and white paper concluding that such attacks cannot be reliably mitigated at the software level. Instead, robust solutions to these issues require security boundaries in applications, meaning at the higher level, such as web browsers, to be aligned with the low-level primitives. For example, process-based isolation. And of course, we've been talking about process-based tab-level isolation because tabs are sharing process memory unless they are put in their own processes. They said, in parallel, browser vendors and standards bodies developed security mechanisms to protect web users from these classes of attacks. This included both architectural changes, which offer default protections enabled in some browser configurations, such as site isolation, out-of-process iframes, and cross-origin read blocking, as well as broadly applicable opt-in security features that web developers can deploy in their applications. And those are things like cross-origin resource policy, cross-origin opener policy, cross-origin embedder policy, and others. And we'll explain what some of those things are here in a minute. They wrote, these mechanisms, while crucially important, don't prevent the exploitation of Spectre. Rather, they protect sensitive data from being present in parts of the memory from which they can be read by the attacker. In other words, Google is acknowledging that Spectre really is going to be an ongoing problem. So the best we can do is to understand the nature of what the Spectre problem presents and then give web app developers the tools they need should they choose to understand the problem and restrict the way their web apps operate to make them safe against, you know, proof against Spectre. But my reading of reality says this is going to be a big lift. The tyranny of the default is going to come back. And since these additional things, these clear mitigations are not required, and if they are applied inartfully, they can break things that work without them. I'll be surprised to see. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what degree of deployment they get over time. So they said the low-level nature of speculative execution vulnerabilities makes them difficult to fix comprehensively, as a proper patch can require changes to the firmware or hardware on the user's device. While operating system and web developers have implemented important built-in protections where possible, again, site isolation with out-of-process iframes and so forth, the design of existing web APIs still makes it possible for data to inadvertently flow into an attacker's process. So, and I've cut out a whole bunch of detail, but they say, with this in mind, web developers should consider more robustly isolating their sites by using new security mechanisms that actively deny attackers access to cross-origin resources. In other words, you know, you really, really, really want to only, as a web app developer, only have your user's browser working with your site, or where you design other sites to participate in your solution sharing the page with the user's browser. You want to explicitly allow that cross-origin presence, not allow any cross-origin presence. And we are getting the tools in our browsers to make that possible. For example, Google is leading this essentially. These are all standards based, but there's a long list of things that are not yet in browsers. Firefox, for example, doesn't yet have these. So its lack of them means that if they're present, they'll be ignored. And when Firefox acquires them, then it will start honoring them. So there are three that I'll just touch on briefly. And I've got links in the show notes which explain these in more detail. And I'm going to then sort of borrow some language from one of these pages, which sort of helps to characterize the nature of this. So there's something known as cross-origin resource policy, CORP, and fetch metadata request headers, which these are all sort of extended headers, which allow developers to control, in this case, which sites can embed their resources, such as images or scripts, which prevent data from being delivered to an attacker-controlled browser renderer process. And in a minute, I'll explain how that could happen by mistake. But there is a page, resourcepolicy.fyi, and that's the first time I'd seen the TLD of FYI. That's cool. So resourcepolicy.fyi, and then the other one is web.dev/fetch-metadata. Anyway, so this CORP, C-O-R-P, cross-origin resource policy. Then there's cross-origin opener policy, COOP, C-O-O-P, which lets developers ensure that their application window will not receive unexpected interactions from other websites, allowing the browser to isolate it in its own process. This adds, they write, an important process-level protection, particularly in browsers which don't enable full site isolation. So again, if you had this turned on, like globally, and your web app did need some other origin's involvement, this would break that. On the other hand, you can explicitly allow that. So you can sort of think of these things like firewall rules for a browser. You know, it's very much like that. Unfortunately, as we'll see in a minute, the web started without any of this, much as the internet's first firewalls, right, were allow any and then deny bad ports. Well, we learned how that worked out. And so today's firewalls are all, you know, deny all and then allow specific things that you want through. The problem is we're not going to be able to flip that logic around as we did with firewalls in our browser ecosystem. They're just, or the web ecosystem. There's just no way to get there from where we are now. The third one is COEP, cross-origin embedder policy, which ensures that any authenticated resources requested by the application have explicitly opted in to being loaded. They said today, to guarantee process-level isolation for highly sensitive applications in Chrome or Firefox, applications must enable both COEP and COOP. In other words, that is to say, to guarantee process-level isolation. That's the point. If you don't have those, if you don't provide those to the browser, if the web server doesn't ask for that, the browser is not able to provide process level isolation because other stuff from other origins has to come in. So it's only by adding those headers that you are you're telling the browser, lock this down, either no other origins or only these specifically applied or supplied other origins are allowed to put stuff and to interact with this page. So they finish, in addition to enabling these isolation mechanisms, ensure your application also enables standard protections, such as the X frame options, which, you know, I have on my site. It's a bunch of things that you can tell frames that you tell the browser that frames should not be able to do on your site. And there's also X content type options, which are which content types are allowed. Again, just the problem is none of this is the default. And so we've been incrementally over time looking at how the abuses occur, and we are responding to them. Unfortunately, much like when firewalls were all open and like looking at what ports were hurting us and going, ooh, let's block that. Ooh, let's block this one. And just it's not a good way to go. But again, it's the only thing we have at this point. There's no way to flip the definitions over without breaking everything. So clearly, you know, if anyone played with web browsers, if you're not doing it now, browsers and servers and, you know, and headers, it used to be so simple. It used to be get and post, and you'd get back a, you know, and you would send a host header and maybe a cookie or two. I mean, boy, you know, this is not our father's internet any longer. So at that web.dev site on the fetch-metadata page, the site attempts to explain the generic problem pretty much as I have. This guy wrote, many cross-site attacks are possible because the web is open by default, which is, I think, is the best way I've seen of saying it. The web is open by default. And your application, you know, talking to web application developers, your application server cannot easily protect itself from communication originating from external applications. And I'm going to give an example of that in a minute. But he said, a typical cross-origin attack is a cross-site request forgery, CSRF, where an attacker lures a user onto a site they control, which is the fancy way of saying, you know, a user went to a site that was bad, malicious, and then submits a form to the server the user is logged into. Since the server cannot tell if the request originated from another domain, cross-site, and the browser automatically attaches cookies to cross-site requests, the server will execute the action requested by the attacker on behalf of the user. So let me explain that a little more carefully. In other words, an innocent user visits some site. That site displays a page with JavaScript, which, as we know, you pretty much can't live without anymore. You know, even I gave up having NoScript enabled, where it by default scripts. Remember those sweet days when you could actually still use a site without scripting? It's gone. So that site, this site that the user visits, displays a page with JavaScript, which it uses to submit a form with a post query to some other vulnerable site, presumably that the user has a relationship with. The user's browser is performing the form submission post query. So it adds the session cookies, which it has for that site to which the query is being sent, because that's where cookies go with queries. The targeted site sees this as a valid query from a known and logged in user, and thus honors the request, whatever it is. So in essence, the malicious site is acting on behalf of the user without their knowledge. That is a classic cross-site request forgery. And remember that the way web apps work now, back in the, again, the quaint old days, you actually had a form that you would fill out fields and then you would press the submit button and it would send a post. Well, now we everything is web APIs. Well, web APIs are just post queries, maybe gets sometime, mostly posts. So what that what this generalizes to is you can visit a malicious site, which without you knowing it, will be able to send web API queries as if you were visiting another site with your browser and JavaScript from that site was issuing these web APIs, doing all kinds of fancy web app stuff on your behalf that you don't see behind the page. Well, now bad guys can do that, acting as you, impersonating you. So anyway, when the author of that page said that by default the web is open, essentially that's exactly what he's talking about. That, you know, that if we're going to fix this, we need to proactively take action to lock things down. So I like the firewall analogy, I think, is the best example. The fact is, right now you need to very carefully, that is web developers, consider adding rules just in the form of headers to web applications which explicitly permit content and interaction only with the specific origins, that is the other domains, that, and it may be none, that your app must interact with. If that's none, then that's wonderful, because it means that you are enabling the browser to decline any sort of this abuse, and also to know that it can put your entire site's interactions in its own isolated process using the operating system's process isolation features, which are pretty mature, in order to provide protection. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how this goes. My feeling is, you know, the responsible web developers listening to this podcast may already know about this, or if they didn't, I'll bet they're going to go find out, because it's certainly a useful way of enhancing the security of their applications and preventing them from being hacked. The problem is there are many more web developers who may not be clued into this, and there's nothing that the browsers can do to enforce this that wouldn't risk breaking apps. And we know that's the last thing they want to do.